What's up? Welcome to Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650, Jamie Dodd, and my co-host, Canucks insider Thomas Trance, who also covers the team for The Athletic here. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650. 650 is, of course, the Dunbar Lumber text line. Drance, what's going on, man?
Oh, you know, just hanging out, man. I'm on my way back tomorrow, so I'm not on the show tomorrow. Programming note for everyone listening. I'm finally going to be heading back to Vancouver, about 10 days later than intended. So it goes.
We look forward to you making your triumphant return to the studio on Monday. And then, I guess, flying out to Vegas like 2 days later. Is that what we're talking about here?
Also, maybe. might still be remote from Vancouver. This is the problem with having zero connected ligaments in your ankle.
Not ideal. Not great.
No.
You want at least one connected ligament.
So we'll see.
Ligament.
We'll figure it out.
Yeah. Randy.
Maybe I'll Uber in.
Yeah. Randeep Janda is going to be my co-host on the show tomorrow, but we got a lot to get to today. Two great guests on the show. Kevin Woodley will join us at 12:30, and our guy Dimitri, we're moving him up a day so he can be on the show with Drance. He joins us at 1, but lots to get to before we chat with our guests here. We've got another great UFA target list that we can get into, and a little bit of news from Rick Dhaliwal this morning, who reported that Dan Milstein, of course, well-known agent to everyone here in Vancouver, and specifically in this instance, he's Ilya Mikheyev's agent. Rick Dhaliwal reporting that Dan Milstein has permission to help facilitate a trade for Ilya Mikheyev. And of course, we've been down this specific road before with Canucks wingers on maybe inefficient contracts, or at least contracts that look inefficient, of course, with Brock Besser, who ultimately ends up staying, having a very, very productive 40-goal season for the Canucks last year, and also with Connor Garland at training camp or just before the season last season, who, again, ends up staying and has a really, really effective season for the Canucks. So we've known and we've heard the reports that they're trying to move Ilya Mikheyev, that they'd really like to free up that money. That's no surprise. We've also heard from yourself and others that they would be very, very hesitant and very reluctant to attach a sweetener, to retain salary. They don't want to go down the buyout road. And this report kind of sounds like, you know, they're just trying to exhaust every possible option to see if there is a relatively painless way to get rid of Ilya Mikheyev. But I also think the context of just because you hear client, you know, agent is trying to help facilitate a trade, that is often not a guarantee that a trade is actually going to get done, as we have examples of here in Vancouver.
You know, I think that history is important to note, right? Because what happened, I mean, the Garland one's interesting because he'd been on the block for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And then there's a change of agents. And, I don't think there was a request, but there was sort of a, you know, understanding that maybe it would be in everyone's best interest. And then the team, you know, started like 11-4-1, and everyone was like, hey, you know what?
Never mind.
Let's table this. Yeah, this rules. Let's keep doing this. So that one sort of almost didn't have time to get off the ground, you know?
Yeah.
The Besser one's a little different because Ben Hankinson of Octagon Hockey, who of course also represents Jake Guentzel, so he'll be on the tip of the tongue in this market, I'd assume, for the next 11 days. Not to mention that Besser becomes extension eligible, by the way.
Yep.
July 1, although I'd be pretty surprised if that was like a quick one. Anyway, he had permission for like 6-7 months. Like he had permission endlessly. And that deal never came to be. And then Besser really wanted to stay ultimately. And the organization really wanted to commit to him. And then he scored 40 goals and that worked out great. But the reason ultimately that, you know, both the Canucks and Hankinson never found a partner was that teams wanted the Canucks to retain too much. The Canucks would have retained a bit, but they weren't going to retain what teams were looking for if they were going to part with like assets and take on the Besser $6.66 million deal. So that was a fascinating one in part because I think ultimately when we look back on it, I think Vancouver kind of had the measure of the player relatively right, right? Mm-hmm. Like, even though they were open to potentially dealing and using that cap space in a different way, they weren't going to, like, hurt themselves to do it. You know, and teams were throwing anvils as opposed to life preservers, and it never came to be. And that's, I think, the most instructive lesson here, right? Because this dovetails pretty nicely with what we've been talking about, and I've sort of been reporting about this for a while, which is that, you know, it's not like Mikheyev's struggles in the playoffs shocked the team.
Right.
They wanted him on the fourth line if they could figure it out, right? Like, that was where the team was hopeful that Mikheyev could play. It didn't come to pass, and Lindholm didn't really punch up the top six and ended up playing on the third line. And, you know, that sort of caused every winger to play a little bit further up the lineup. Pew Suter on the top line, Dakota Joshua and Connor Garland end up being second liners, you know, on and on. But, you know, that was the hope. And that doesn't reflect the club's long-term assessment of this player, right? This is a player that the club loved when they went out and signed him. They wouldn't have signed him for 4x475 if mm-hmm. they didn't. They thought there was more offensive punch to his game, that he could provide more offensive punch. And what's sort of interesting is that he kind of has, like, that kind of has paid off over the course of 2 years. But we all know he tore his ACL in his preseason Canucks debut, and he's never really shown us the player that the Canucks thought he could be. Now, I think the offensive evaluation, the offensive bet, the bet that this guy could be a mainstay top six forward, you'll remember, like, we were talking about it once I returned from COVID. Because I was on the IR then, too.
You were once again stranded in a different location while we were doing shows. Seemed to be
God.
It happened
in Nashville.
To you a lot, yeah. That's like, this is the third time
weird,
it's happened
eh?
To you.
Oh, man. And we've only been doing the show for 3 years.
Yeah.
So it's like the annual marooning. We almost got through the season without it. Anyway, you'll recall, like, I never liked the bet on Mikheyev's offense, but I never hated the bet
mm-hmm.
on Mikheyev's defensive ability, speed, you know, and sort of ability to punch up what at the time, like, do you remember how slow the Canucks used to be
yep.
as a team? Like, their team speed was, it's easy to forget now because they actually were a legitimately fast team, certainly on the wings last season. But, man, they were so slow. When they signed Mikheyev, I was like, okay, I get it. You know, I get it. I think, you know, I think the problem you're going to bump into here is that he should play on the third line because the Maple Leafs tried it. Like, it's not like they didn't try giving Mikheyev the Bunting and Hyman role over the years and you know, giving him significant, like, hundreds of minutes with your Marner, Matthews, Nylander types. It's just he didn't have enough finish. And so I thought that bet was a tough one. But I also thought he will make them faster. He will make them better defensively. He will make them more effective on the forecheck. I can see that fit. And then we never really did get to see it because of the injury and then the surgery and on and on. The club thinks he's going to bounce back. Like, they really do. They thought this before his, you know, when he was like 30 games with one goal, right? Where his,
yeah.
his goalless streak was like at 15 games. Like, hey, that's concerning, but it's not a big deal yet. As opposed to 61 games and he flubs a glorious breakaway opportunity in game 7. And that really sort of changes the narrative around him, changes the sense of urgency. And by the way, because there was, you know, at this time, I was also saying, I think this guy will have trade value. Well, you know, I like 2 months ago, I saw someone on Twitter, you know, a listener say, well, Drantz said that he'd have trade value. And I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
That was one goal in 25 games. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, obviously it changes when you go that long with that many plum opportunities. So anyway, I like Mikheyev as a third liner. I think one of the issues that they'd had with him in Toronto, though, was that this guy doesn't think of himself as a third liner. So there is, you know, like, that's something we kind of talked about with Friedman, right? Where
mm-hmm.
it's like, there's value in having a guy who knows exactly where he fits,
mm-hmm.
right? And stays dialed in no matter where he's playing, versus a guy you have to manage as you bump him down the lineup. You know, his confidence was obviously shot this year. I do think his speed kind of began to return a little bit, which I think is a very promising sign. I think there's a real possibility that we, you know, get to Canucks training camp, wherever it is, and he's flying again. Like, he looks like the same player he was, because now he'll have 2 years sort of behind him since the ACL surgery. And So I think the club would love to create that space if they could. I think there's other priorities, the other things that they would love to invest their money in. I think there's enough wingers on the market that you could find a fast guy to replace him. You could find a defensively reliable third liner, which I think is where you're going to pencil him in.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think there's a world where what teams want to help the Canucks create that space, exceeds their appetite. And I think if that happens, the team's going to be comfortable with him returning. Is it plan A? No, clearly. But is it something the club can live with? Is it something where they still believe that he can help them, even if the cap hit is outsized? Yeah, I think it is. So this is one where it's interesting. I think it's telling about all of the sort of frying pans that the Canucks have on various burners, both front and back. But I don't think it's fait accompli. You don't draw a straight line to this building your Canucks lineup, your dream Canucks lineup, without Mikheyev in it necessarily. It's still going to be a hard deal to do, given that the team still believes in the player enough that I'd be relatively surprised, not shocked, but relatively surprised by significant retention or by the club parting with a significant sweetener to get off the deal.
And the context that you mentioned there about how he viewed his role in Toronto and maybe one of the motivations for him to come here beyond the money and the term was the opportunity at a top six role. I think that's also interesting context for the agent getting involved in this, right? Because if the Canucks have kind of internally shifted to, you know what, we really, really like you as a third liner, but we're trying to upgrade our top six. We're not trying to have you there next year. That provides some motivation for Milstein and the player, or Milstein from the player's perspective, to say, well, hey, is there a location where he can go be a top six guy out there? It does remind me a little bit of the Connor Garland situation, where it's not that Garland ever requested a trade. It's not like Mikheyev is requesting a trade. It's just, hey, we get it. You're looking to trade me. I'll see if I can help out to see if there's a mutually beneficial arrangement here. Now, Chet and Burnaby texts in, signal or noise, does the report that Milstein is trying to facilitate a Mikheyev trade mean the Canucks are big game hunting and confident they can pull it off? I don't think that they have to trade Mikheyev to go big game hunting, right? We've talked about it. They can easily do, for example, Jake Guentzel with Mikheyev still on the roster, bring back Tyler Myers and fill out the rest of the roster relatively easily. Not ideally necessarily, right? You're not going to be able to do a bunch of premium ads in your bottom six in that scenario, but you can do it. I think where the Mikheyev salary becomes more of a domino that needs to fall one way or another is, and this is matching the reporting by Rick Dhaliwal, is with regards to their own unrestricted free agents that they'd love to keep but are going to be pricey, and that's Nikita Zadorov and Dakota Joshua. And I know Rick Dhaliwal said on Donnie and Dolly today that Zadorov and Joshua, and of course Zadorov, same agent as Ilya Mikheyev, so obviously a lot of understanding from Dan Milstein on the situation here, but Dhaliwal saying Zadorov and Joshua, their camps willing to stay patient with the Canucks because of the Ilya Mikheyev situation, right? Because of the understanding that if the Canucks are able to clear either the full freight of that contract or something very, very close to it, that all of a sudden the Canucks might be able to go to a different number for both Zadorov and Joshua, or at least one of them. And I think beyond the big game, and really when we're talking about big game hunting at this point, we can probably just plug Jake Guentzel's name in there. So beyond the Jake Guentzel factor, I don't think they need to trade Mikheyev to do that, but I think they might need to trade Mikheyev to do that and Zadorov and or Joshua.
Yeah, I think that's more or less right. I saw Rick also floated Joel Edmondson's name as a potential size replacement in the event that Nikita Zadorov goes to market and the club's unable to sign him. And I just want to quickly react to that by saying pay Zadorov whatever he wants. I'm only partially kidding, but like very partially, because one thing about Zadorov too, right, is like we talk about it, you can find a big body defenseman in free agency. They did it. But can you find a big body defenseman who, when you're having like a moment in the offensive zone and the other team's on their heels and they get the puck, they still have the skill level to make the play?
Yep.
Or are you reacting to it the way you reacted with every Mikheyev scoring chance, where it's like no, don't shoot it, man, just put the puck back down low. Zadorov crosses that bar with flying colors, and Edmondson does not. not to mention the struggles pivoting when defending the rush.
A lot of other guys don't, right? And that is the difference with Zadorov, and that's why he's going to command more than a lot of the other, like, hey, big body defenseman X that we can get to, some of whom I think are very interesting targets for the Canucks, and I would have no problem with them as a plan B. But you're right, like, that's the extra little sizzle that Zadorov brings that a lot of other 6'5", 6'6", guys just don't have, and that's something that the Canucks have been missing, right? But, like, even after the addition of Filip Hronek, you would still say, man, could they get a little bit more playmaking, a little bit more offensive contribution from the blue line? And so I do think that's an interesting factor with Zadorov. Now, I still think you have to be very disciplined with what you ultimately pay him, right? But I guess it does just come down to, okay,
but
so
Jamie,
how about this? Hold on.
They already will be.
They will be, yeah.
We know it because it's not done yet.
Yeah, that's a good point. They haven't met whatever the asking price is already. So that's a good...
Could change.
Yeah. But I guess, we've been talking about, do they believe Dakota Joshua has more? Like, has a bigger role to grow into, and that could justify the contract? But I guess you could pose the same question with Nikita Zadorov. And, you know, they were... you made the point that they would love to at least try out Filip Hronek on a second pair with somebody at some point. Like, could that be a fit? If you're willing, if you do end up meeting the price with Nikita Zadorov, is that a place that makes sense where he brings some of the physicality and the size, but still has enough offensive upside or enough offensive talent to kind of credibly hang with Filip Hronek on a second pair?
Well, but potentially, but how much of a premium are you going to pay for that when Soucy is already signed at 3.5?
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like, how much of a gap do you see between Zadorov and Soucy if you see one at all? Right? Playoff deployment suggests that as things went and as Zadorov was cooking, you know, Tocchet began to prefer him a bit. Certainly Zadorov, has more like secondary puck mover value than Soucy, but like Soucy's got a good shot, right? Like Soucy's scored 10 goals in this league before. He's pretty good from the blue line in, you know, even if he's not as good in transition or not quite as dynamic moving his feet. But you know, there's also the argument to be made that he's maybe a little safer defensively. Certainly the fact that he was the guy hard matching McDavid would suggest that that's what Tocchet thinks. So, you know, how much of a premium are you willing to pay to sort of duplicate a lot of what Soucy already brings to this team?
Yep.
You know, that's sort of where I think it gets tricky. Again, it comes back to the hard reads thing. Like I remember there was a joke when I worked with Florida. I won't say who the player was, but there was an unrestricted free agent and negotiations were tough and everyone knew that, like, really he just loved South Florida and wanted to stay, but things were sort of getting late in the process roughly this time of year. And it was like, you know, every week for a month, negotiations would fall apart and it would be like, well, we're losing him. And then, you know, 2 days later, the camp would call back. It's like, okay, well, that's, you know, so that's the tough reads, right? Like, that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about tough reads, where it's like the fact that both sides are still talking, even though there doesn't seem to be progress, the fact that it's like final offer time, and then it's like, they're willing to be patient. Like, okay, so they haven't built the bridge yet, but everyone's still on like either bank eyeing one another. And when that's happening, it kind of becomes a game of chicken. It becomes like an understanding that you're not going to get max value from us, period. Like you are going to have better offers on the open market, but we like you and we'll go to a certain point and you'll take a certain point. And it's like, are we going to finish construction of this bridge? Right. Or are you ultimately going to find something, you know, more appealing that doesn't cause you to cross the river and go somewhere uncomfortable. And it's really hard to tell at this time of year. Like, it's hard for teams to know this. Teams struggle with this themselves. You know, I guarantee you that reporters, commentators, fans struggle with this too. Like, when you're in those sorts of situations, and I think they characterize both Joshua's situation and Zadorov, although I think Zadorov's is a little more active. You know, when that happens, it's like, don't assume that the Canucks won't move themselves, right? And don't assume that Zadorov won't move, right? Like, one side or another might blink here. And it's you know, or both blink and both get to a place where they're somewhat uncomfortable, which is usually what it takes to get a deal done. You know, those, like, the team, I think, feels like both Zadorov and Joshua are going to be difficult to do, right? Mm-hmm. That's difficult to do hard reads. Those are the things, like, our listeners can take to the bank in terms of describing these situations. But so much is going to be up in the air over the next 11 days, and I don't really have a way of handicapping it yet beyond saying that, you know, I think the team's prepared for the scenario to happen where the bridge doesn't get finished, but certainly they're still interested in building it.
I'm putting you on the spot a little bit here, but just quickly before we go to break, because we talk about them as a package, but there's also every world where only one of them ends up returning, right? Do you have a sense of, like, if it came to that, okay, we only have the money to do one of these contracts, which would be the priority from a Canucks point of view?
Joshua or Zadorov?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's got to be Joshua. Personally, I think it's got to be Joshua, but I also think you shouldn't underestimate the extent to which Joshua's in a position to be like a bidding war target, yeah, of multiple teams on July 1. I think Zadorov is too, but I think that bidding war money still keeps you in a realm that you're like, you've seen before. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm, it's not outrageous for us to see a guy who, like, most of the industry rates is like, hey, you know, a second pair guy, probably get 5 or 6 if you're a big minutes defenseman. Like, that's within the realm. Like, you're basically getting good Branson plus, right? Like, that's certainly an argument you can make for Zadorov. Whereas, like, Joshua, I think you could really see something, you know, that detonates your framework for a guy who made $800K on his last deal. Like, I don't think 4 is outrageous. I've been saying this for a long time, especially given the level of interest and how unique the skill set is, and the fact that there's really not a lot of players that match his profile out there in free agency. The price that Tampa Bay paid for, like, the idea of a player like Joshua for Tanner Jeannot,
yep,
right? I mean, like, teams love hard, competitive guys good enough to complement skill players. Period. Like, they love those guys. So anyway, I still think Joshua's the guy that I would probably prioritize of the two, mostly because I think there's a more straightforward path for Joshua to play higher up the lineup and sort of in a very straightforward way justify a ticket that you're uncomfortable with, as opposed to Zadorov, who's just got a longer track record, who I really think, you know, second, third pair, you know, like, it. It's hard for me to see a case for paying, you know, a guy who's been a 4 or 5 type defenseman for 600 games in the NHL, like $5 million, and counting on him to be one of the 60 best defenders in the league, justify a top pair kind of, you know, pay rate. Whereas I can absolutely see Joshua performing to a level where he could justify 4 or 4.5 just by being a top 6 forward the way he kind of was down the stretch for this team.
Okay, we'll take a break. Kevin Woodley joins us next here from In Goal Magazine and NHL.com. Lots of goalie stuff to get into with Woodley. That's coming up next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Vic Nizar. Have your say and join me on The People's Show with big takes and even bigger bets weekdays 3 to 4 on Sportsnet 650 or wherever you get your podcasts.
Coming, they knew our fame. You can't tell us how to win.
Welcome back. A little vocal rejoiner music from producer Dom Shermati.
It's knock off thinking about tomorrow.
Sure. With the vocals. Glad we got those in. Canucks Talk, Jamie Dodd, Thomas Trantz. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the Kintech studio, and we're very pleased to be joined in studio by our guest right now from In Goal Magazine and NHL.com. He's a presentation of White Rock Hyundai, and he is our guy, Kevin Woodley. Kevin, what's going on, man?
Not much. I figured, you know, now that I'm driving an Ioniq 5 for my friends at White Rock Hyundai, it doesn't cost me any gas to come down and visit you guys in person. Just recorded a PDO cast with Dimitri, and yeah, I'll fired up to be in studio. And now I find out that, like, I'm in studio, but Thomas can't get here because he can't drive. with his ankle. Like, what? Thomas, come on,
Woodley's
man.
He's not buying the story,
like,
man.
Dude, I broke my ankle in four spots, or my foot in four spots playing baseball in the States, and literally drove a stick shift through the border at about a half an hour border wait. It was my left ankle, by the way, so I had to work the clutch with it.
Like,
through the border to
like
get
right away.
Back. Like, right away. Cause,
like,
well,
right away.
Like, well, after the game ended. And so, and it started
to
look like a
watermelon. I drove myself home that day from Joshua Tree, which was about an hour, but then the swelling and everything, and you become
aware of the
damage.
Just get on the freeway and put it in cruise control. Like, can you get which ankle?
I thought about it.
It's not like you're working a clutch.
It's my right ankle.
So, like, ambidextrous,
right
drive
ankle.
With your left foot. Little, you know, you can get through out of the city with your left foot and onto the highway, cruise control. Yeah, come on.
It wasn't going to be a good thing to do given I completely severed two of the tendons in my ankle. I like don't even think I could really significantly hit the brakes right now.
That brakes are overrated anyways.
Who needs it? That's not a big part of driving, right? Anyways, Woodley was unimpressed when I explained to you why you're stuck in
California. Didn't mention severed tendons.
He was like, "Wait, what?"
He didn't mention
month. I'm on a 3 to 6 month timeline, Woody. 21 hours of driving and just like flexing, and then the fact that I can't really put enough weight on the brake, it just wasn't feasible.
All right, there's the injury report on Drancer. 3 to 6 month timeline. Hopefully not all in California. Hopefully we'll be able to get back in the studio.
Do you guys
get
some of that LTIR credit for that or what?
Who are we going to bring in with the LTI space? We can bring in a stud with Drance makes.
Kevin, can you go to twice a week?
Yeah, and I'll drive here for it.
Oh man. All right. Okay. Let's get into the Stanley Cup final a little bit here. I mean, this is a great time to have you on because there's been a lot of goalie transactions and stuff, and then obviously goaltending. Still front and center in the final as well, which, boy, it's not over yet. Not going to end tonight. Might end tomorrow. Might not until next week. It's a long one. Sergei Bobrovsky, so much positive attention on him for the first three games, playing so well, has not been the story over the last couple of games. What's changed for Bobrovsky?
Well, I mean, first of all, the first three games were like otherworld Bob, right?
Yeah.
Like, understand, like, Clearside had his numbers for the first three games, and it was especially 1 and 3 because 2 he wasn't asked to do that much. But in 1 and 3, like those first three games, he was, I think, plus 5.34 goals saved above expected. For the entire playoffs up until the cup final, he was plus 5.5. Like he was otherworldly Bob. And so takes the step back in game 4, and everyone's like, oh, will he bounce back? Well, yeah, of course he's going to bounce back, but expect him to bounce back to the heater of all heaters that he was on was probably unrealistic. I think two things have happened. One, during those first three games, the Oilers figured out that, hey, you know that pre-scout our goalie coach Dustin Schwartz built for us? We might want to start paying attention to it. Because I guarantee you some of the ways they were attacking him early in this series were not how it was drawn up. Like know it, guarantee it. And so you see the breakaways, and what do they have, 5 in game 1? And they try and go down, they try and attack in straight lines. And some of those are situational, in-tight breakaways, not like they're coming through the neutral zone with speed and a gap on the defender. But straight lines, Deke's in-tight. If you're straight lines on Bob, you shoot. Unless you have the pace and the separation to pull him from and to attack wide and go from one side to the other, you should be shooting every time. And they didn't. So they tried to beat him down low in tight, which is exactly, it reminds me of Artur Shelov's in the second round. They kept trying to go low slot line play and gave Shelov's a chance to play to his strengths. And Bob's a hell of a goalie. If you allow him to play to his strengths, he's going to make saves. And he's going to make momentum-changing great saves. And he did early in the series. Now you see, much like Shelov's, they're working plays from up top. They're not afraid to shoot from distance. And listen, everyone's like, oh, shoot from distance. Like, you just want to throw a bunch of, like, 99 percenters at the guy and let him feel good. But when you get rush chances, if you can't make the types of moves you're hoping to make or create the types of lateral plays, then shoot from between the top of the circle and the hash marks. You can catch him transitioning out of that high stance, and they have a number of times. Traffic, point shots, guys spreading out wide to try, and again, he comes out past the top of his crease on open looks in zone. So make him push across and use the space that naturally exists because he doesn't rotate back to his post between him and the post on those wide plays. He is an incredible goalie. But again, the first three games, I felt like even the looks they got, they played more to his strengths. And in these last couple, when they get looks, they're actually attacking him the way I would draw it up and the way I'm pretty sure Dustin Schwartz is drawing it up.
So in terms of tomorrow's game and then potentially a game seven, is it more almost on the Panthers skaters to kind of make adjustments to try to take away some of the new looks that Edmonton is going to? If they're attacking Bobrovsky in a way that's kind of inherently targeting his weaknesses, I mean, that's tough for Bobrovsky to adjust to, right? But are there things the Panthers can adjust to a little bit?
Well, I think in general, they've been looser than we would have expected them throughout this series, right? And Bob just cleaned it up in the first three games. Like, they've given up a fair amount of chances. I thought it got better as game five went on, and maybe some of that is being behind and chasing and just, you know, score effects. But it's not like you need to do a bunch different. You just need to get back to who you were. And I think they have, you know, like, I think a lot of people thought this would be a short series because they thought the Panthers would dominate them and they had the advantage in goal. And I just think it was more about the, I don't think they dominated. I think the, well, I guess game two, they were pretty full value for that one. But in one and three, their goaltender outplayed the other guy by a massive margin. It's just, it was such a margin and such a performance that expecting it to continue all the way seemed unrealistic. And yet, he only needs one more.
Is there something about whether it's how they attack goalies, whether it's what they're seeing from defenses, but is there something about this Oilers team that makes them more dangerous to your eyes as the series goes along? Because it does feel like they've, you know, been way more imposing in every phase of the game, especially though the power play and how they adjust to attack goaltenders once they've had some looks. We've seen that consistently throughout the playoffs. Vancouver, Dallas, and now Florida, I think, have all had a front row seat to this.
Yeah, I know. It's a good point, Thomas. And it's actually a good question. One I'm not sure I have an answer for. I guess in some ways the answer to how they seem to be attacking Bob is part of it. Like, they make adjustments, right? And their ability and willingness to adjust and to not just keep trying to, you know, hammer a square peg into a round hole because this is how we've always done it. And I think we saw that, you know, we got a first hand look at it here against Shelovs, right? Like, if they had kept trying to beat him down low and try and beat him with east-west passes and, again, play to his strengths, I don't know that they win that series. But they start doing things way out of character. Pucks, screens, like, they tripled the rate of screen chances per game that they generated at the end of that series compared to the series prior. So I do think there is an adjustment there. But there's a little part of me, though, that's like, okay, is this a coaching adjustment or is this the players just realizing that the pre-scout actually, because it should have been there. Maybe Shelovs is an unknown quantity, not so much, but this should have been the pre-scout on Bob right away. And maybe it took a little while to be like, hey, you guys might want to listen here because what you're doing isn't working. But at the end of the day, whether the adjustments are coming from the coaches or the players being more willing when things don't go well to listen to the coaches, you have to give them credit because they don't just keep trying to beat you the way they beat everyone else. They become increasingly dynamic and willing to sort of alter how they do things. And it's worked. It helps when you have the number one player in the world. Like, we got into a massive debate in the goalie world about the one that McDavid sifted through Bobrovsky's legs. Like, to me, that's going to be the end-all, be-all. Every time an announcer or somebody on Twitter says, just stand up when an RVH goal goes in, I'm going to play that one. But the truth is, if Bob drops into his reverse early on that play, McDavid has his head up from the bottom of the circle. He can go short side high and hit that 3-inch gap between your head and the crossbar and the post. And I'd still rather take my chances on that than the 2.5 feet between the legs down low. But it just, I think he is obviously leading the charge on this increasingly dynamic, intelligent, mature attack that's willing to evolve as series goes on. When you have the best player in the world showing that, leading that, and creating those types of plays, I think it increases the odds that everyone else will A, follow, but B, just everyone else looks better because he's creating the seams and the openings that others can take advantage of.
What about Stuart Skinner, in terms of, I mean, we've seen now he's struggled early in series on occasion, right? There have been lots of series, the last three series. At some point early in the series, it was like, man, Edmonton's disadvantage in net is really playing here. And then as the series goes along, Stuart Skinner seems to find his game. What are you seeing from him in this series in particular?
You know, it's interesting. I think in this series in particular, you could make the argument that just getting to know the opponents a little better with time, because he doesn't see a lot of the Florida Panthers. It didn't make as much sense to me in the earlier series. And I guess against LA, there was no adjustment. He was just fine. He had a couple early in that one too.
Yeah, he had a tough game.
Yeah, and Vancouver obviously lost the starting job, and those are teams he should know. So at least in Florida's case, like, you're going to learn tendencies, who's a shooter, where they're going to shoot. Like, there are things that you will get more comfortable with as you see a team night in, night out. I'm just not sure that's entirely it. I do like the routes he's taking. I still think there's exposure there and would have some criticism. And this isn't, it's not even meant to be negative. It's just he's a second-year starter in the National Hockey League. And so his off-puck awareness will improve with time. But right now it's one of those areas where we saw it against the Canucks. You know, sorry Canucks fans to have to hear this again, but JT Miller in the slot with 13 seconds left in Game 7 on a puck that's below the goal line, he never once looks away from the puck below the goal line to see where Miller is. And so if it doesn't hit Zadorov's knee, the entire far side of the net's open because he hadn't looked off the puck. And, you know, the puck's in a non-dangerous area in the corner. Look off. We've seen that in the Stanley Cup playoffs. The difference in Game 1 where Nurse and CeCe blow it, and the puck comes out to the high slot, and Skinner actually pushes to the wrong position because he has no awareness of where that attacking player is, because, he hasn't looked off the puck and scanned the zone, even though it's in a non-dangerous area, to the other night with Ekblad on the back door. I don't see him look off again, and I still think that has to improve, but instead of coming out to the middle, he prioritizes angle over depth. He goes across his crease, and that gives him a chance to get his eyes on the puck and puts himself in more of the net to make that save on Ekblad in a reactionary manner. And I think we saw it a little bit too in the Verhaeghe chance. And it was an 8-1 game, but a lot of people pointed to that as a momentum changer. I still don't love where he is positionally on the initial shooter. I think he overplays it. Just like I think the first goal of the series by Verhaeghe, he needlessly overplays Barkov. He's outside his post and Barkov's on his backhand at the faceoff circle. You can make that path to Verhaeghe so much easier and get there with your legs over your pads squared up on him rather than the gap that Verhaeghe found. If you play that, you cheat it a little bit because you can handle a Barkov backhander from the dot without having to be outside your post and squared up on him. You can react to it. And I think even on that Verhaeghe save, there's an element of overplaying the initial shooter that makes him late getting across and putting him into desperation mode and just sort of, he sees it and he sprawls across and plays hit me a little bit. But again, the path he takes has improved as this series has gone. He's working back to his post and putting more of that big frame of his in the net rather than coming across flat like Bob does. And Bob's so fast he gets away with it, but coming across flat and sort of leaving some short side exposure that earlier in the series he was doing and Florida was taking advantage. Now, the flip side of this is if Florida, like they were early in the series, like they were so deadly, their top guys were just ruthless in their finishing. If they got a chance, it was, in the spot, the goalie, like it was high, short side on a lateral play. Like, didn't need to go against the grain. And a couple of times as the sort of we've gotten into win the cup mode, they've pumped them back into the middle of the net and given Skinner more of a chance than maybe even he deserved. But I do like the way his path within the crease has improved as this series has gone on.
All right. Around the league, a couple of goalie deals yesterday, and probably the most notable, at least from the goaltending perspective, Jacob Markstrom finally traded out of Calgary to a long-rumored destination with the New Jersey Devils. How's the fit in your eyes for Markstrom with the Devils?
I mean, the challenge here is the fit's going to change because they also change coaches.
Right.
In theory, it should improve. If you look at what Sheldon Keefe did in Toronto and turned a team that relied too much on goaltending to one that, frankly, by the end, like, didn't. Right? Like, they, well, I guess this past year maybe less so, but in the years between, they were a team that, got turned Jack Campbell into a .920 save percentage and a $25 million contract because the environment got so much better for goaltenders. The Devils sort of rely a little bit. They're a bottom third defensive team.
Yep.
Calgary for most of the season was a bottom three. And so you need an acrobat, right? You need a guy who can make sensational saves. They give up a lot off the rush. And those are all things that Markstrom should be a fit on. I look at the breakaways. One of his greatest strengths statistically over the past couple of years has been breakaways. That's something they're third worst in the league at giving up. And I don't just mean everything clean cut from center ice. I mean everything in tight from the hash marks, anything that turns into a one-on-one. I look at slot line plays across the middle of the ice. And even the Devils as a team, their goalies actually they give up too many. I think they're 20th. Not an area you want to be 20th in. Some of the most dangerous chances you can create. Their team, their goalies actually outperformed it this year, which may have surprised a few people.
Yep.
But when you break it down further, low slot line, high slot line, so down low below the hash marks across the middle of the ice, that's where they had more troubles. And guess what? That's where Jacob Markstrom excels. So in the environment of the past, statistically speaking, he should be an excellent fit, which is why I said they should have done this deal before the deadline and maybe gotten into the playoffs and seen what he could do. But how much of that profile statistically, defensively changes under Sheldon Keefe? And at the end of the day, he's going, this is sort of awkward to say about the New Jersey Devils, but he's actually going to a friendlier goaltending environment compared to what he was in Calgary. And, you know, it fell off a cliff for him in Calgary after the trade deadline. Yep. And how much of that is his best friend in Lindholm and then maybe his second best friend and longest standing teammate in Tanev and then your other top pair defenseman, Hanifin. Like, the environment fell down too, and he had to be personally disappointed. But up until that point, he was not just the leader in the clubhouse for the Vezina Trophy statistically. He was lapping the field. Like, there was a point leading up to the deadline where Jacob Markstrom was a full 10 goals clear of second place Connor Hellebuck and Thatcher Demko in goals saved above expected. Like, he was Superman for the Calgary Flames for two-thirds of this season. The Devils don't maybe need Superman, but they need a reasonable facsimile. I don't know what, like, the, like, bad Superman version of that is. I'm not up on my comic book lore. They don't quite need that guy. Like, they don't... They're a team that requires
they need,
great,
like,
goaltending.
Aquaman.
But,
like,
yeah,
second-tier superhero.
Oh, easy. Can't go there, can we?
Yeah, that's...
Like, did Trance just compare Jacob Markstrom to Homelander?
Apparently.
Yeah.
It's Aquaman, we'll say. Yeah.
Less evil.
Well, yeah. I don't know. I thought we were looking for like, no name brand.
There's
Superman.
There's just a morals
in that
Homelander.
Yeah, there's an underlying theme.
They don't
there
need
Homelander.
Evil
we
Superman.
Don't need to. Bizarro world. Like, yeah, I don't know. We'll just. That was a bad comic.
I
book
I thought we
reference.
Were talking about superpowers. I didn't know. Sorry, like, I didn't know you guys needed a superhero who was also, like, an ethicist.
I don't know. It just sounds, it's a tough comparison to make to anyone, I think. Okay, and the other goalie gets moved. And a bit of an afterthought in this deal, because for the general NHL, because so much of the focus is on Pierre-Luc Dubois, but Darcy Kemper going to L.A., what's your perspective on just, you know, likelihood of a bounce back, how much he helps L.A., all of that for Kemper?
Well, so, like, likelihood of a bounce back depends on two things. How much of last season, and listen, it was bad. Like, 98 goalies qualified. He was 97th in goals saved above expected, almost minus 20. But there were a lot of injuries, and you got to think that played a role. So as long as you're comfortable with the health status of Darcy Kemper, everything he did up until the Cup and even that first year in Washington was sort of, you know, top 15, top 20-ish goaltender adjusted numbers in the NHL. Playoffs in Colorado, obviously with the eye injury, the numbers fell off a cliff. The bounce back in Washington, if it's health that caused last year, then I'm comfortable he'll bounce back in LA, and there's no better place to bounce back as a goaltender, at least raw numbers-wise, than the Los Angeles Kings. And Cam Talbot being an NHL All-Star last year is Exhibit A of that. So he'll be better. The numbers we see at NHL.com will be better this year. Just how much of that is team and how much of that is Darcy probably depends on, you know, the questions that may still exist revolving around his health.
Woodley, great stuff as always, man. Appreciate you doing this. Appreciate you coming in studio, keeping me some company while Drance is laid up in California. We'll talk again soon.
Yeah, you know, Drance, like, these White Rock Hyundai EVs I'm driving are fantastic. I could probably buzz down to California on, like, no gas, a couple, you know, just plug them in a couple spots and just come and get you home. We'll there's a thing called Bring a Trailer where you buy cars in the States and they ship them home. That's the other thing we could do. We could just sell a car, put you in it, and have it shipped back.
Well, thank you, man.
Mail,
I appreciate it. I'll make
home.
All the inappropriate superhero references on our way back.
We'll get our superhero references dialed in for the next time we're in studio together.
Yeah.
All right. That
Rorschach.
Is Kevin Woodley of... No, that's even worse. That's way worse. That is Kevin Woodley, of course, a presentation of White Rock Hyundai. Visit the showroom on King George in White Rock or whiterockhyundai.com. More in-studio guests coming up here. Dmitry Filipovich from the Hockey PDOcast going to join us a day earlier than normal. So that's coming up next. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line as well, so you can keep your thoughts coming in. JanPro, the leaders in commercial cleaning and janitorial. If your workplace demands a clean environment, contact JanPro for a free, no obligation quote. Visit jampro.ca. More Canucks talk on the other side. Sportsnet 650.